start of interview with Hector Abhay Wagner, 27th of December, 1967.
One general subject, I was quite interested in, was what I call a traditionalistic cry, you know, the emphasis on past traditions, particularly revolving around religion, and a critical stance against the materialism of the West and emphasis on the Sinhalese Buddhist race, you know, as part of that. But in a sense, asking people to go back to certain traditional practices. And the type of individuals who present, you know, looking at taking specific individuals, while you find them emphasizing this traditionalistic culture, they themselves have certain, definitely Western attributes. So I was wondering how individuals reconcile this and how the people to whom the appeal is made reconcile these attributes.
Yes, I think. We, particularly in the last 15 years or so, the people who led this so-called Buddhistic response, were highly westernized people, or people with a certain westernized background, who for one reason or another has been driven to rather perverse oppositional stances. I think the phenomenon it reflected was largely that of middle class envy. Essentially they belonged to a westernized or a westernized section of the middle class. But either because of personal frustration or because of wrong influences which they couldn't outlive, they began to resent perhaps not so much the ways of the upper classes as the fact that the upper classes distinguished themselves by these ways so completely from those who had failed to arrive there. The revolution,
but they themselves had some of these ways, didn't they?
Very markedly. Mm-hmm. And even those who hadn't these ways, in other words, who hadn't a cultural identity with the upper classes, or didn't share that to any extent, many of them aspired to have it. And I think you found during the period of the Selepi government, many people, even unable to talk English, who used to go to clubs and used to talk about belonging to clubs more than actually going there, showing that their aim really was to arrive at the positions which were occupied by the westernized upper sections of the
society. You said perverse oppositional
stances.
I wanted you to elaborate on that.
Well, I think that in the majority of cases, these were not genuine political attitudes. They were the signs of personal frustration. And in many cases that I know, they were motivated by antagonism to either particular individuals or particular groups in society. I think that the BJP, for instance, derived the greater part of its following from sections in the government services, in the public services. The BJP, the Bauddha Jataka Balavarga, they derived their following among the lower ranks of the public services. And invariably these people found themselves dominated by people whom they regarded as Christianized elements. who, for one reason or another, were able to find their way out.
Would NQ Das fall into this category?
Well, I think NQ is one of them. Though certainly he was one of the more cultured and more cosmopolitan among them.
But wasn't he in a powerful position as G.A.?
Yes. Now this is, I think, one of the extreme examples of what I would call some perverse illustrations of the perversity of some of these people. I think it was frustrations in his personal life and perhaps some personal or temperamental qualities that led him in this direction.
What about Bandaranaike himself? Wouldn't it be possible to class him as a middle of the road who ultimately left the UNC because of personal frustration?
It is that Bandaranaike was in very much the same category as the Marxist leaders who came after him. The attempt in both cases was to find a passage from the universal Western values that they had absorbed in the course of their education abroad, which made it extremely difficult for them personally to reconcile themselves with the indignity of people like themselves, experienced by people like themselves abroad, and which drove them to critical attitudes towards Western domination, and the phenomenon of colonialism, imperialism, and so on. Mm. Now, in the case of Bandaranaike, coming to Ceylon very much earlier than the Marxist leaders, came also from a European climate which had not been so completely pervaded intellectually by the doctrines of Marxism. His attempt to identify himself with the people, with his people, and to provide a leadership to them in some kind of reaction to this horrible phenomenon of colonial domination, therefore was thought of in primarily personal terms. And he attempted to establish his identification with the people personally by taking on their dress, by learning their language, and by demagogically identifying himself with the Marxists. In the case of the Marxists who came after them, they did it more abstractly, through organization, through ideals, and through finding on a certain level of abstraction a resolution of the conflict between their alienation from their people and at the same time their identity with their people in opposition to imperialism.
To make a hypothetical point, to perhaps stress their common root, would it be possible to say that Bandaranaike might have been a Marxist if he had been in Europe in the early 30s and late 20s?
I think so. In fact, I would see Bandaranaike the same type of personality as Nehru. There was a very considerable resemblance between the two personalities, coming from aristocratic backgrounds, educated by private tutors and so on, absorbing the genteel values of British culture. Old people as well as from the common British people, and going to British universities, distinguishing themselves there, and coming back and trying to find a point of identification with the people at home.
Of course, he succeeded in identifying himself much more closely than the Marxist leaders.
Well, I would say yes and no. Because take a man like Philip. Philip was a man of the Marxists in the sense that he came from a Buddhistic background, from a rural background. And he was a person who understood the climate of the village. And I don't think he estranged himself from the people, even in the course of his long period of residence abroad. When he came back, greatly educated and with a cosmopolitan outlook and so on and so on. But he returned to his people. determined to organize them, to lead them into movement, to free them from imperialism, and so on and so on. Similarly, I think with people like Leslie did not come from that background. He came from a foreign background. He was a Christian, and upper class, owning considerable property, and so on. Went to British public school, and so on and so on. But when he came back, he put on the national dress, learned Sinhalese so much that he was able to write it better than Philip or anybody else. And I think he returned to a closer identification with people than many of the others. But in the case of Colville and Enid, I would certainly draw a distinction, because they were primarily intellectual Marxists. And Enid was driven more by a conspiracy of fate than anything else into politics. And I think he would have very easily fitted into an academic environment.
In fact, perhaps one of the greatest mistakes made by the right wing was not to
give that job in the university, correct? I think so. And it is a great tribute to him that having come into the LSSP, he stuck there. And what is more, he remained perhaps the only full-timer, apart from Leslie was also one. But he gave more of his time to the Marx movement than any of the others. Colvin, of course, did not go even so far.
Turning again to Bandar Nayaka, isn't it correct to say that he put himself at the head of certain rising forces in the 50s? Or in fact, the forces chose him rather than saying that he created them and marshaled them. It was just that they were already on the upsurge, and he was a convenient symbol, convenient center of unity.
Yes, in a sense you are correct, but I would qualify it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there were two stages in Bandar Nayaka's evolution. The first, where he did not distinguish between an urban political career and a political career at the head of the rural Marxists. Distinction in his mind, and therefore he plunged himself into politics in Colombo. In other words, he hadn't yet thought seriously about the problems of politics in Colombo. Now there, he found himself defeated. He could neither fight Gunasinghe.
But he beat him.
Yes, after that election. Mm-hmm. But he could not compete with Gunasinghe for leadership of the common people in Colombo. And he could not fight the Sejanaka leadership on a national scale, operating from Colombo. It was only when he separated in his mind the mass of village Sinhalese from the urban working class and the nondescript city population, that I think he found the springs of his potentiality. And it is not accidental that he rationalized his program in terms of the Sinhala Mahasabha, purely Sinhala and Buddhist. That was the straight appeal to the village masses.
And then through his local government...
And this is where I would qualify it even a little more, qualify your statement. Because he worked consistently to build his base when he was Minister of Local Administration.
So this shows a certain insight and a certain identity.
Yes, and also a certain amount of party. He saw that he had to work step by step to build a political organization for himself.
On the other hand, in support of my statement, taking the 1950s itself, you've got various, you've got these forces rising to the four morning, and you've got various groups developing quite independent of Bandhanayaka. I mean, the EVP, I think, was one. Was the Idiogara in that?
He's not really closely connected with the whole process.
And various groups. And secondly, they even thought of asking Dudley to be their leader, and they approached him before they approached Bandhanayaka. And then again, one can say that Bandhanayaka himself didn't realize that he would win the 56th election.
But I would say that one has to distinguish between the general trend that was the product of accumulated history, one might say, and the particular phase of marshalling of these forces and organization of them and the victory at the election. Undoubtedly, there was a period in which this element of the priests and the school teachers and the Ayurvedic physicians, a period where they thought that they could challenge the anglicized sections of society for a political power. And they felt that with the steady blows given to the UNP by the working classes in the town, they could sort of find their way by short-circuiting the proletarian struggle. They could find their way to political power. And Bandhanayaka, himself looking in a similar direction, sort of effected a junction with them. And in 1956, was able by rallying also the left behind him to win power. But this whole thing was conjunctural, because in the first place, this kind of politics cannot clearly understand either its own significance or its potentiality. It has to test it out, and it is only through victory and defeat that it discovers how far it can go. So until 1956, came about, they did not realize their own potential.
Yes.
And after 1956, they exaggerated their potential. And that led ultimately to the defeat of the selected.
And again, with reference to the point I stressed earlier, that he more or less put himself at the head of these forces which are already on the upsurge. Would it be correct to say that these forces forced him into a more extreme position than he would otherwise have taken? I would instance language policy. I think SLFP in 52-53 was far less communalistic, far less single only than say 55-56. I don't know
whether
I'm correct, but...
Well, actually, I wasn't here during that period, so I can only talk very indirectly about this thing, out of my direct knowledge of that. But I feel, at least I always felt, listening to Bandhanayaka, that his emphasis on language was demagogic. He did not take himself seriously. And left to himself, he may not have attempted to introduce single-only overnight. He would have played on it, exploited it to its fullest, and gradually perhaps introduced more single into education and administration. But I think it is permissible to say that he did not take it so seriously. But once, in order to come to power, he effected a junction with these elements, they certainly pushed him much further than he was willing to go. And it was in resisting them that ultimately he was assassinated, isn't it?
Coming back to the point of the question of tradition and westernization, could it, and even looking further into the past and at figures like Harishchandra, Dharmapala, and others, would it be possible to say that both that crowd and the more recent crowd took in certain Western values and Western forms and used these as instruments to block further Westernization? They sort of partially incorporated certain things and then prevented a sort of total diffusion and absorption.
How concretely, what would you refer to?
Well, I suppose they were forced to fight Westernization with essentially, with tools which are essentially forged in the West, like using the newspapers, pamphleteering, things like that.
I think the problem here is really what is the Westernization that they combated. I think in the case of Harishchandra and the Angarika, Westernization to them was some kind of nostalgia for the greatness of their own past. In other words, it was some kind of cry of their souls for the feeling, for the condition of impotence and prostration before the conqueror in Ceylon that they experienced. In other words, it was a name for a certain spiritual condition experienced by them.
As a protest arising from a feeling of humiliation.
Of humiliation, essentially. So, the Anagarika, for instance, did not consider a motor car as Westernized. His caravan, for instance, was very much the product of Western culture. But he, to him, that was a thing to which he could legally lay claim. Similarly, when he went about promoting the need for the development of industry in Ceylon by Ceylonians, he knew that a firm like Don Carlos's was essentially a Western idea. He did not reject that. To him, the Westernization that he fought was the values of the Britisher in Ceylon.
And the dominance.
Yes. His cultural values, you might say, his habits, his the names that he had given to the Sinhalese people at the price of their own names, their dress, which they had imposed on the Sinhalese people, their forms of living,
club life,
things of that kind. Everything which proclaimed the superiority of the culture of the conqueror to the culture of the conquered. So it was, I think, essentially this condition, or this process, that one must have in mind when one tries to understand the protest against Westernization.
Does that apply to the 40s and 50s too?
Well, in the 40s and 50s, the protest was not so much against Western habits as the foreign habits of a local class.
Yes, that's right.
So, in other words, the amenities, the superior amenities enjoyed by the upper classes in Ceylon, which were laid claim to by Western education or by English education.
So, would there have been envy too behind this?
Oh yes, there was social envy. There was much greater social envy in this case than earlier. Because in the case of the Anagarika and so on, it was not envy.
It was a rejection.
It was a rejection. Here it was envy.
Because now, for instance, a point made by Rajasvinidharika about the University Commission and the emphasis on the traditional culture. And when asked to going to detail, he could only bring in various trivialities there. I think he tilts at that.
Yeah.
And then he also tilts at LJBS Thirumalakna and the fact that he rides in a car while making all these protests and, you know.
I think Sarachandra puts this very well in the course of the seminar we had on regional cooperation,
mm-hmm.
when he said that the emphasis of the Vidyalankara and Vidyodaya authorities on the development of their own culture in their education was not irreconcilable with the demand for putting up structures very much similar to that of the Theravada University. And if at all, in the making them perhaps taller structures than those at Theravada.
But you feel there is a dichotomy there? Or is there? That's the point.
Not a dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say here the essential feeling is that of the poor relation.
Mm-hmm.
And the poor relation, while he resents very much the richness of the other relatives, at the same time his one ambition is to get on par with them.
I was wondering if the analogy is quite fair, because you would imply that the traditional culture is poor.
No, it has nothing to do with culture.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do entirely with the incomes which those who are said to belong to the traditional culture enjoy, compared with the income which the others enjoy.
But how does the lower income group gain by emphasizing the traditional culture?
It emphasizes its distinctiveness, firstly, and by idealizing the past in the direct line of inheritance of which it claims it stands, it is able to use the past as a weapon against the present.
Mm-hmm.
And this both helps them in their personal struggle against those who are better off than themselves, and in their struggle for recognition of the traditional culture, which they feel is being neglected.
Again, going back to Dharmagarika, all right, he was protesting against Western values and rejecting them. But was he wholly? Didn't he have certain Western values which he used to tilt at the rest?
Yes, I would say so, certainly. In his sermons or his speeches, he used constantly to tell his audiences why they should reject the names of the Westerner, the clothes, the whiskey, and the ball dances and things of that type. At the same time, they should acquire the virtues of the Westerner and use them to the fullest. I think he did make that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the case of the Anagarika, it was what you might call a rather primitive example of an anti-imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first man who summoned his people to a recognition of their self-respect. At least an exploration of that system.
Of course, speaking about dichotomies within individuals or even within parties, sometimes these questionable things. For instance, you take a point made by Robert Kani, with reference to the left movement, I think he says that there is a dichotomy between their emphasis on the parliamentary role and at the same time a belief in the revolutionary power.
Mm-hmm.
Is it necessarily a dichotomy?
But I think that in the peculiar conditions of Ceylon, it did entail a lot of tension between these two beliefs. On the one hand, the opportunities of Parliament were so immediate and apparently so immense that people belonging to the Marxist Party threw themselves completely into the parliamentary forms of politics and struggle.
And that affected their thinking.
Yeah, that affected their thinking. But at the same